Nancy and Rosemary have both accomplished so much during their lives, of which founding Wellspring House was one incredibly important achievement, that when I was searching the web for biographical data on these two dear friends, I was awestruck. For more than 50 years, Nancy has been an educator, an activist for social justice, practicing the theory of Paulo Freire that education is the key to the transformation of poverty. Her vision and leadership in advocating for homeless families and creating affordable housing and educational opportunity at Wellspring House, her policy work at the state and national level, her mentoring of so many, have created a profound legacy of hope. Currently, she works as a visiting fellow for the Center of Social Policy at University of Massachusetts. In addition to founding Wellspring House with Nancy and five others, Rosemary has authored over 35 books, some 200 articles, founded two communities of hospitality for the troubled and homeless, received several awards and honorary degrees, been an international lecturer, and is the mother of 10 biological children, several foster children, and numerous grand and great-grandchildren, and is a person who has been called a lay theologian, even though she had no formal theological training. Over the past decades, Rosemary and Nancy have been profoundly important to so many of us because they have not only taught through words, but they have taught in the most real way by walking the walk. Our community has been so lucky that they chose almost 40 years ago to settle here. I cherish three principles they've taught me. We can approach life from a place of abundance, focusing on people's capacities, not deficiencies, to create change. Hospitality, in the deepest sense, is what is needed to rectify this crazy world. In the words of Vincent Farini, we are the gardeners of each other. How we are to each other is a big part of what success is. We do have to be the change we want to achieve, and we can take risks to make it happen. These principles, which they have lived out with such ardent grace, they have given to us as little seeds that now flourish in the work we do out in the world. At the Gloucester Writer Center, we consider them patron mothers, and we try to live out their principles of hospitality with attention to action and reflection, word and deed, and most of all, knowing that all our voices count. So it's our great honor to welcome them, to hear about the book they're writing, and to look forward to ongoing dialogues with them. Thank you.
I think what Rosemary and I would like to do is, before we tell you about the book that we're writing, which is about Wellspring, it's about our experience of living at Wellspring, working at Wellspring, we'd like one question that we can start this conversation with. One question about, we're here tonight to talk about Wellspring, as Annie said, to talk about the theory and practice of Wellspring over the years, and how all of us together and with all the families and individuals we work with are making social justice, because we're making sure that all kinds of people can be in the conversation. So I don't know if you've thought of a question, but we would welcome a question to begin the night with.
I could ask one.
Yes.
Can you at all sort of paint the landscape of the period of time when you started Wellspring and what it was that kind of made you, what that evolved out of?
Okay. All right. So the landscape. You want to talk about the social landscape?
Yes, we had a very similar question from Melissa a few days ago. And It's a difficult question to answer in a way, because it's both very personal and very broad, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a landscape, therefore, that has a foreground and therefore also a deep distance. And the foreground for each of us and for all the other people who got together in some way or other at the beginning came out of a very different kinds of experience, but what the experiences had in common was an awareness of the need for work for social justice. We were, all of us in different ways, very aware of just how lacking in justice was the systems in which we lived, whether at the local or the national or the global level. And a sort of, we in different ways belong to different spiritual traditions and drew from that a conviction that it was our responsibility to respond. And it wasn't something that we knew those people over there ought to be taking care of. So that it was a very personal thing, and we'd already had experience of trying to respond to that conviction that it was our responsibility in different ways. And so what brought us together was both that awareness as individuals, but also the kind of encounter and the ways in which we met each other and found that we needed to be together. Would you agree with that? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think, yes. I mean, we were, except for Kathleen, who was my foster child at the time, who was 17 when we started Wellspring. All the rest of us had really, even if we were just children, and I was quite young at the time. Rosemary had very different experience because she was in London during the war. But I would say the experience of World War II was just a memory for us. And that we carried with us also with the hope that there would never be another war. I mean, we were excited growing up, and Rosemary was about the United Nations. You know, we were going to be together in peace. So there was that background. The other background was that we were all children of the 60s. I mean, we were a youth of the 60s, but by goodness, what a time of revolution it was. And so it was civil rights, it was the women's movement, it was, you know, the peace movement. It was all of those movements again that affected all of us. So that's really what we brought to a conversation, really, which happened in a parish where I was working at the time, and Rosemary was a visiting theologian at the time, and Carol was part of that. And we were talking one night in these ice-breaking questions. The question was this: what would you do with your life now, if you could? And when we sat and talked about that, the common theme was we would leave what we were doing at that point. All of us were working for bureaucracies. I was with the church. Paul was with the school department in Peabody. There were different bureaucracies that we were part of that were doing good work, but they were big and they were not as responsive, I think we could say, to the issues of justice. And the fact that in that group, several of us responded the same way, that by the time we ended that night, we said, we can't ignore this. We need to respect the fact that several people have said this, and we need to get together again. And we did. And some people joined that group. And we talked about it and talked about it and reflected on it and kept saying, what would it take? What would it look like for us all to quit our jobs at that point, to find a place that was large enough for us to share so that we could share it with other people who needed a home for a while? Because that was one thing that we had all had in common. We all had taken in, had welcomed into our homes people who needed hospitality. And doing that alone can be a very lonely, and it can be a really hard, hard situation. So that was really, that was the core of it. And once we could spell that out and also know realistically the challenge it was going to be to share a home together. And the big thing was we really didn't have any money to do this great thing that we thought about. But once we sorted through, we kept talking about that. And I said this the other day to the staff at Wellspring. At one point, Mary Jane Berenice said to us, "We're going to talk this idea to death. We've got to act." And that, of course, is the whole Ferrari thing of you reflect on your experience, you reflect on your experience, and then at some point you have to act. And in, before you act, you imagine what you're going to do. And then you have to get very concrete about what you're going to do. So at that point, then we became much more concrete about what it would take. And we began looking for a house and where were we going to be? And we thought, you know, hey, we really do want to offer hospitality to those who need it the most, so we should go into Boston. We should possibly go to Dorchester or Roxbury. And we all kind of looked at each other and thought, what's that going to be like? And then we thought we should go to Lynn, right? And then we said, and then finally Paul was able to say, Paul Berenice, who was assistant superintendent of schools in Peabody, and administering Title I grants for the federal government and the state government, Paul said, you know what, if I'm going to make this, Paul was his late 50s, if I'm going to do this, I need a place of beauty. And he said, I just hope we could look at Gloucester. And Gloucester, because he knew of the poverty that was behind the doors. You can, you know, you may not be aware of the existence of, but so that really is, that was it. So there was this broad social context, right, behind us, and we came into a time in government where people became, you know, it became a different kind of economics. We weren't going to take care of each other, and then we all had this experience, and so that's kind of the kernel of it. Okay? Yes, Nubar.
So just to follow up on that a little bit, I wonder, so since then, you both have attracted hundreds of people to everything that you do to have built this, these extraordinary things that have happened. And I know, because I know you both a bit, I know how it feels from out here. I wonder how that feels for both of you.
Well, first of all, we didn't do it.
Right, that's good.
Everybody here. I mean, and really, I believe that. I mean, we, you know, that's the way these things happen. And it's happened all over the time. You get an idea, and you and connections are made. Look at, with Nubar, this incredible internationally known photographer. And Annie knew Nubar, so when we needed to put out a black and white beautiful, anytime we needed photographs, and we did this most amazing capital campaign, and Nubar did the pictures for this. That were just, that's how it happens. And those photographs, Nubar, were so important. And I came across one that I had gotten, we gave awards to people who were part of the Capitol campaign, and I got one. It had the picture of that the children on the swing. Remember the one you took?
Right.
I mean, unbelievable stuff. And that's how it happens. I mean, we all have something to give to this this process. And, you know, sheltering at first, cleaning the house, for God's sake, once we bought it. I mean, it was a mess. It smelled of cats and oh, it was unbelievable. But, you know, everything from that all the way to, and today that continues. There are hundreds of volunteers that make it possible. We were volunteers when we went. We didn't have any salaries, let me tell you. We had to all go out and get jobs and put money in. But I think there's that spirit of incredible generosity and a community.
I think when we began telling each other we needed to write this book. Well, it was, other people were telling us the same thing. The first, when I struggled to find an introductory idea, and I realized very quickly, but that idea was that things like, the, well, spring, things that are new and exciting, they are not the creation of one or even two people. They happen because somebody has an idea and it resonates with someone else, and then we talk about it, and more people say, yes, that's it, but I think so and so and so and so. So you get all these ideas sparking off each other, and very soon it gets to the, what Mary Jane said that Nancy quoted, we can go at this for years, but we've got to do something. And then it takes off, and the doing attracts more people. And a part of the process, which is also very important as time goes on, is things go wrong. You make terrible mistakes. You look at it and say, is this finishing us, or can we see what it is? And it starts the whole thing again, because you look very deeply into what you're doing, see whether things are not right, look at it, look at the newness that's coming out of that. Because it's very easy, people talking about Wellspring, who haven't had the very deep experience of it, to assume that because it became eventually extremely successful, that nothing went wrong. In fact, that's been used as an accusation at times, that we were just idealists who got lucky and we didn't really know what we were doing. Actually, we had very good advice in business and law right from the beginning, and we knew that we had to make the right decisions at every level. So it sort of blew up in all directions, and people got the sparks, and all sorts of things happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In a time when people are praying about gun violence, and certain people are also saying, let's not pray, let's act, what is some spiritual things that you can say about where you came from? Because I always felt it, but you never were out there pounding a drum, but it just, I felt like it was there. But can you put any words on that?
The spirituality.
Your spiritual.
Well, I think part of it was in the, at a certain point, when did we make up the mission statement? When did we deliver?
The one that's in the Wellspring story was written in 1987, at the time we did the first strategic plan.
Mm-hmm.
And that took an awful long time to write. I remember that because of that phrase, we are a community of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's going, oh, don't put that in. You can't put that in. They're going to think you're this, you're that, you're something else. But we believe that faith, for us, faith meant the assurance, the awareness, right, of something. And the awareness was that
each
person, each what, how does it go?
Each life touches
every other life. That was it.
And that's how it works. And that was, and then it goes on to say, because of this, as it were, our work and our decisions are guided by the vision of a just society. So that's the connection, that's the faith, that's the motivation. We can make a difference. We can't solve everything.
Finish reading it.
Okay.
Please.
Well, I'll read the whole thing. Wellspring is a community of faith, aware that each life touches every other life. Our work and our decisions are therefore guided by the vision of a just society, in which we must care for the earth and her people by using our resources, property, and land in a spirit of hospitality. In this spirit, we work to meet basic human needs and participate in social change through the provision of shelter, affordable housing, local economic opportunity, and education rooted in community needs.
Bravo.
Well, Jim, does that answer a bit?
Oh, I can. could ask so many more questions. that's good enough.
And I think that tradition is rooted in all faiths. I mean, you know, we were very much impressed by Jewish faith and by Christian faith. But it's in the Muslim. It's there. I mean, any faith is talking about our lives are connected, and our responsibility is to take care of each other, and that really is what it's about. It's this whole sense of mutuality, the culture of mutuality, and goodness sakes, if we could, because now we live in individualism, you know, each one get what you can get, and not care for each other. Yes, Martin, I'm sorry.
In the beginning, did you consider the Catholic Worker House model?
We we knew about it because we had friends who were in the Catholic Worker, and at one time I even met Dorothy Day when she was very old. And admired them very much, but it didn't fit the way that things developed for us. And the reason was that we felt it was important to ask the people who came to us, for one reason or another, to take the responsibility for what we did together. So that was no sense of waiting for us to do something. There were needs, of course, people came to us with needs, but their needs were something that they could share with us, and we had needs too. So there was always a conversation, and sometimes it was a rather heated conversation. But it was very important that there were two sides to this conversation. So in that way, we were not Catholic Worker in some senses, but of course we knew very much and admired what they were doing, still do.
But I think that what Rosemary said is so true. I mean, we were working full-time jobs outside so we could get a salary so we could put $500 into Wellspring each month, because that's really for the first year is what paid the bills. When people came, the understanding was as they met with us that we'd all share in the cooking, we'd all share in the cleaning. And when we started to have families before we got the state contract, which we didn't get until 86, we basically asked families who came to share. they were getting welfare, but we asked people to share what they could of their welfare.
Was it about 10?
And it was, it was different for different, but that was all we could do, and people did. And there is a sense then of mutuality. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we did very, very intentionally was we never called families who came to us clients. They were always called guests. And we were the hostesses and host, and yet at times we also were guests. I mean, that's the nature of that. So that's how. That was.
Yes, and that's the hospitality bit, and it's at so many different levels. The hospitality with hospitality to people of any kind, but also to ideas, to perhaps sometimes shocking ideas, challenges that people brought to us, and instead of rejecting them, we tried to say, does this make sense? What does it mean to us? You know, and that wasn't always easy.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an interesting thing about hospitality, though. At the practical level, when we began, we got all kinds of people coming. We had people who had alcohol problems, young people who had been thrown out by their families. We had homeless families, which was the more obvious kind. And we soon found we had to make rather bitter decisions, rather sad decisions. We had one man with us for a while who was very, very drunk most of the time. And we came to the point where we had to say, you can't come into the house unless you're sober, because it was so upsetting for the families who were there. We found that, you know, we had to set, in other words, we had to set limits. We couldn't accept people with abuse, substance abuse problems, and we any kind.
Or people women directly coming out of domestic violence, because we were too well known, and they were not safe. Mm-hmm. I mean, to come, and in all those years, though, we only had two instances of where the abuser threatened to hurt Wellspring House. And that is, I mean, but that was the reality. I mean, we had, in those early years, we had times when a woman who was terribly abused was, the police would bring to Wellspring at night. And our question was, why isn't her the abuser out? But at that point, you know, we're early on. There was no legislation that protected women in that case. There was nothing that said the abuser's got to go, and it was so that's the learning. That was also the learning of what we could do, what we couldn't do. You know, and I think that's also something that's important. But I want to say also about hospitality that also is where we got into really the care of the earth and the garden and food, growing organic food, and all of that. I mean, that's all part of it. What kind of atmosphere do we create? And that when families called for help, I remember one time a woman, Carol, rang, and she had been burned out. She had lost so much. And Rosemary answered the phone. And later Carol said, it was the first time I called for help from an agency or for whatever, and someone said, met my feelings and said, I don't know what we can do, but we'll do everything we can. Do you have transportation? Can you come down to see us? And that, she said, that was the beginning of feeling welcomed and feeling like a person. So every level, every telephone call, everything, it's what it takes. Yes, Nan.
I didn't realize that you had originally requested money from people when you needed it. Now, and then you didn't. So did you ever feel like maybe people would have behaved differently if they were contributing in any way financially?
No, I think we just didn't see. We didn't see ourselves. I mean, we kind of thought, here we were, seven people. We were going to do something that we really liked to do. And then, phew, before we knew it, right? But what we found was that in the mailbox, there would be an envelope with a check or an envelope with $25. Thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. And, I mean, we had a budget. And five of us were able to give $500 a month, and that was our first budget, and that had to pay two mortgages, and food, and utilities, and you can imagine. And sometimes when we held our breath, it was that $25 or that $50, and people would come flying in the house and say, "We're going to be okay, gang. We're going to be okay." But that was it. No, we didn't. But it happened, and we did not have tax-exempt status. We applied, and I think it was 3 years, you know. But generosity was there right from the beginning. It was there. So, Jane, you wanted to ask a question.
I had the feeling when I was teaching there all the years in Richmond that people were living and working the mission statement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was very strong, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Really paid attention to
mm-hmm.
what our mission
mm-hmm. was. And
I suppose that's true, because the working out the mission statement was a result of experience. Mm-hmm. And my bit of the experience that I brought to the project at the beginning was partly out of my experience of a community in Scotland that my family started, not me personally, but a whole lot of them, and other people came and joined in, and it was hospitality was the basis of it, We had to help each other. Everybody had to do everything, or nothing would have happened. That has a long and separate history. But it was right from the beginning, my family had worked on the basis of if people need something, we'll try and supply it. You know, and sometimes we did made terrible mistakes, but it worked. It worked in forming people. And this is my grown-up grandchildren, as well as my children, who I think, thank God, they may not be very religious, but they know that looking after other people is what matters, and in all sorts of ways, and it's exciting. Mm-hmm. And you've had that experience, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if I could just switch, just because I want to be sure that we also talk about education. And in this way, really, the way we made decisions was basically based on our very kind of recent immersion into the educational philosophy of Paulo Freire, the Brazilian educator. And his pedagogy of the oppressed was something that some of us studied, but we knew what happened was we knew from previous experience that in a sense we were already doing it, if you know what I'm saying, because it comes out of experience. Paulo Freire did not want banking education. He said, this is not about pouring information into people's heads. That's not what this is about. This is about, he believed, because he was the head of education in Brazil, and he believed that very much, that the key to the education is the key to the transformation of poverty. And what he meant by that was, it's not just individual poverty. That the whole thing of poverty as we know it, as a terrible social, disaster, is only going to be transformed when we are all educated. In the education process, we are both student and teacher, back and forth. We're both learner and we are those who are taught. And he believed that deeply. And the way he basically started to really work with people who really had no jobs, no formal education, was pretty much in getting them to paint houses. And then they would stop and they would talk, they would have questions. And his question was always to get them to ask questions, a deeper question, a deeper question, a deeper question, a deeper question. Till they wouldn't ask questions about just they would finally get to why are people poor? Why am I poor? And then they would begin to understand that it was basically the social reality that was keeping people poor. But that was their own, they would come to that their own understanding and then begin to mobilize as communities together. And people were learning to read, to write, to take on these things because they really saw themselves as part of the change. And every time, and I'm sure I see some of you nodding your head, I mean, there's something to be with people and know that I'm not the teacher, I'm not the expert. We all share that. We all share that. And every time, you speak or ask, I learn from that. And it's very mutual. So Paulo Freire had his, and we were doing this, and finally we found a theory to say what we were doing, which is so often happens, doesn't it? Action. You act. And then you stop and you reflect. You reflect on what you're doing and how is it meeting what it is that you want it to meet, or the goals. and you go deeper and deeper in that reflection and take the time that you need that you need to take. And then what feminist educators have added to this is you then imagine what it is you want to make. You don't just jump in. You imagine together with a group of people, with the people with whom we're teaching. What's the next step? What do we need to be doing? And then, imagining it, you begin to do it. And you imagine it by starting to look at what is this reality that you want to make, right? And then what is it going to take us to do it? How many years? So if we want this to happen in 3 years, if this is the goal, if this is what we imagine, we've drawn it, we've done everything to it, we know it, we own it. So what's going to happen? That's going to be 3 years. So what are you going to have in place in 2 years? And what are you going to have in place in 1 year? And what are you going to have in place in 6 months? And one of the things about this is, and I used to always say this, this is a process. So don't tell me we have a little, this is where we want to go. And then when we get halfway through it, you say, oh, it's not getting anywhere. We got to chuck it. We got to do something else. No, we're in this. We can maybe readjust a little bit, but we got to see it through. And I don't know what your experience is. But that's a hard thing to do. But if the vision is clear, then you hold on and you encourage people to know that this is, this strain, this whole thing of waiting is all part of it. But let's not chuck it. Let's stay with it. So that was incredibly, incredibly important for us. So that's praxis. It's the interaction between action and reflection, constantly back and forth. And for me, that makes, and basically, people, you're low income people, whatever. As somebody said, we're acting out of abundance, out of capacity, not out of deficiency. Sorry, I know you want this.
Yes, I do. just because while I was listening to you, I was thinking alongside that of the experience that we'd had at so many different levels over the years at Wellspring. When it became larger and there was a larger staff, and it was no longer possible for the entire group to get together to make decisions, so people were meeting at different levels. Directors of programs met together to talk about what they wanted to do and make decisions, and of course when we were working with the guests, we met with them in a group sometimes, and of course individually, to help people to reach decisions together. But then the decisions we made and the decisions we imagined were also, at a certain point, we had to share it. We had to take it more widely. It's what you were talking about. And I'm thinking of, how many was it, 4 times altogether, that we got, first of all, after 5 years?
10 years.
10 years. We invited all the families, the women who had been in our shelter programs, and got them together to say, what was good for you out of this, and what was less good, what should we change, and what do you see for yourselves in the coming years, and we got together and had a big conference. We got two wonderful friends of ours to speak at that conference, and we'll talk about them maybe. But what came out of that was a plan, a 10-year plan, wasn't it?
It wasn't really a 10-year plan. It was the fact that the 40, there were 80 formerly homeless families, that the heads of which were agreed to be interviewed, one-on-one interviews, and then there were also focus groups. And as Rosemary said, you know, tell us, what was it like for you here? You better, you know, hold on, and you got plenty of, it was great, and I got to go, but you know what? Some of it was really not good. and then we said, so what's your life like now? How are you making it? And it was amazing, because so many of them were relying on parents to kind of get them through financially, and how many of you need, you know, are using, and they would talk about needing to use food pantries and stuff. I mean, and then what are your hopes for the future? And basically what they said was, we want to get off welfare. We want, you know, we want to be able to, we want to have good education that let us get good jobs. And we want to get off welfare. One woman said, to be on welfare, it makes you feel like you're a cigarette butt and you're being, you know, squished into the pavement. That's how it makes you feel. And I can't wait to get off. So they wanted, I mean, they said it all in this report. We are like you, except that we're poor. We want for us what you, we want for us the same things that you want for your families. We want affordable housing in safe neighborhoods. We want good education. We want jobs that pay a living wage. We want childcare for our kids. And in the end of that, they said they wanted community. Interesting. So when we had this forum, which Annie Thomas had been brought on to take care of the 10th anniversary celebration, I hired her. I think she was in CVS. We met one morning. I said, Annie, how would you like a job? She said, what? I said, so, brilliant. And so we had it at Gordon College. We had 100 and some people who came. And they were from every aspect. They were from colleges. They were from medical. They were from education. They were from all streams of community life. And then there were 40 women who had done the research, which was participative action research, and just amazing. And we published it that day. We handed out the copies of the results of the, and it was We Are Like You. And out of that, this group of people got together and they basically said, we have to have a committee on this, a working committee on this, and a working committee on that, and a working committee. We already had some things going, and then it fell to the board of directors when they met in February. Well, they were meeting all, did a feasibility study, but, and they met in the chapel in February. I will never forget it. And Carol Ackerman, who was then chair of the board, bless her, stood in front of the board and said, okay, we've done the feasibility study. We need to get a vote tonight whether we're going to do a capital campaign, because we've got to choose to grow, or we're not going to be able to meet what people want, the dreams that people want. And so I still remember her taking the vote, and I remember, you've heard the story before, Barbara Simpson, who at that point was almost 80, standing up on a chair in the chapel because she was so short, and she said, I don't know about the rest of you, but I think I have one more capital campaign in my blood. Well, she said, I want to tell you, if you agree, if you vote tonight, then every one of you is going to have to dig in your pockets like you've never dug before. You can never go and ask other people for money unless you're willing to give. And they voted that night and then set the goal, and we had $1 million, and everybody said it'll take you 2 or 3 years in this financial climate. We did it with about a year, got a national grant to build the center. And, you know, it just is that thing that I just believe, when you get a whole bunch of people working together and believing that you don't look at what you don't have, you look at what you got to have. And so that was just amazing. Yeah, that was the first one. The second one was...
Wider, wasn't it?
Was wider, and it was a viable community. I mean, how can Wellspring help participate in Cape Ann, Gloucester being a viable community? And that we did participative action research. I know Jeffrey was part of that with Catherine Zappone, who was one of the women who was here, and she did a whole participative action research thing, and we published on We Love This Place. It was all about Cape Ann. It was all about what were the things that needed to happen on Cape Ann for us to really be a viable community. We weren't going to do it all, but it involved a lot of people. So we did four of those. I mean, every 5 years there was something, there was gathering of the community, the greater community, to say, what can we do together? And then deciding. anyway.
There's something I'd like.
And I think we're getting too.
Are we getting too long?
Yes.
No, sorry.
Well,
are we okay? I just want to say that a lot of people have said to us, oh, aren't you wonderful? And you've done such great things. And what I remember about it is that it just seemed to be the obvious thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it's very embarrassing when people sort of kind of say, ooh and ah, and isn't it great? I mean, it is, you know. But it's what human beings do for each other when they're not constrained in the wrong ways from reaching out. So really, that's my experience of all those years. It never seemed to be odd or difficult. Well, of course, it was difficult at times doing it, but it never seemed unusual. I mean, it just seemed this is what we do, you know. And I know so many people in this room know that from experience. They feel the same. So we don't need the your wonderful thing. It doesn't help.
I used to always say, please, because don't ever put us up on a pedestal, because that gets us away from the people, and the worst thing that can happen is that people start burning incense. And then we're done for, because you know that then the whole dream is done for. You know, you got to keep it really, you know, and it is. But you know, it's the thing that it is what happens when we really believe in caring for each other, and that we have to. There is that we have to, and not just for here, but people who are very different from us, Well, one thing that I really is so wonderful that Wellspring is doing now and is the work with the immigrants in the community. Mm-hmm. The language is done. I mean, that this is the group of people now. These are the people who really need the sense of hospitality, mm-hmm. of being welcomed, and of being and it's wonderful that right now I know from Melissa there's focus groups happening in the community with translators that we need if we're going to understand, you know, what it is that people who aren't speaking English smoothly are saying to us. And they have a translator. They have somebody who can speak Spanish, and someone who speaks Portuguese, and someone who speaks Arabic, and what's the fourth one?
Those are the three.
And really, I met some of that. We Rosemary and I talked to the staff. Met with the staff last week. And you know, when you really see the excitement and the dedication of these women who are doing the translation for these folks, and asking, what do they need? What do you need? What do you need in this community? From you know, what do you need if you're going to make it here? And this is a very fragile time. I mean, I don't have to tell you, in terms of the national, you know, all the rhetoric and speeches, and it's a time of hate, and it's a time of all this stuff that is just horrible. And that's why I really the more we can be that bishop who spoke at that wedding, who used love 60 times. He used love 60 times, and he told him, and at the end he said, you know, I got to stop now because I got to get you all married. And I just absolutely love it, because, you know.
He didn't stop.
Huh?
And he didn't stop, he just kept going.
He kept talking about Desjardins, which I loved, you know, the new fire and his love. But then he was, if we love each other, there won't be any more poverty. There won't be this, there won't be that. And that's, you know, that may sound, people say, oh, come on, you know, no. And mutual respect.
What was so cool was he even said, and maybe we'll even be family.
I know. I know. It was wonderful.
Can you speak a little bit to the whole how to break down classism? Because I know, like, with Writers Center, some of the groups, it's like having the common goal of writing, of people learning language to express themselves. That supersedes barriers and differences on some level. I mean, Dorothy can speak to this because she's done amazing work with the veterans groups. But how did the commonality of your environment of people living together work that way? Because that was, to me, was partly so amazing.
Well, I'll give you one example.
Okay.
Some of you remember Ellen Kelly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so we seven got to 302 Essex Avenue on August 3rd. And we had a lot of people helping us clean the house and getting rid of the smell of cats that had been living in the house while the three guys went to Boston to do their work in Boston. And anyway, and then we looked at each other, and we used to meet every week as a community to talk about where we were and what was going on. They'll tell you a couple of things. One was that here we were, six women and one man, Paul Veronese, Mary Jane's husband. And no matter what happened, and we had to have this agreement that we would all make decisions. I mean, we would be informed. But if anybody came, we could say yes, okay. Well, this was the experience. Every time for the first months that a worker came to the house, they would ask for Paul. And I can remember one time being there and saying, I can take care of this. No, I really want to talk to Paul. So Paul bought in. And you know me well enough to know.
Where's the boss, right?
You know, where and so Paul, and he said, when the guy left, he said, you're not really happy with me. And I said, no, I'm not happy with you. And I said, and it falls to you to be the one to say, you can't do this. You can't, you know.
It falls to Paul.
Huh?
Yeah.
So he did. Paul took that on, which was major, you know. So anyway, so that was, you know, and when we went to Wellspring, Paul knew he couldn't use the clothes dryer. He had to hang his clothes out on the line like the rest of us did. And he had to clean the room, and he had to iron his own stuff. And this was major. I mean, this was really major breakthrough. But God, we'd be downstairs and listen to the vacuum cleaner going, and Mary Jane would laugh. She says, he's doing it, do it again. I am. So here's Ellen. Well, I had to tell that story, though. Yeah. We said we're going to tell stories as well as theory. Yeah. So Ellen Kelly was the first guest to come to Wellspring. She had been burned out on Thanksgiving Day. She had been living, she was really, really a very, very sad person because she was really living on the streets for a good part of her life. Ellen was born to a Catholic mother, and the mother was not married. And the family were so, they insisted that she have the baby, but they, whenever Ellen in those early years, the mother put her in foster care right away is what I should say after a few months. And whenever Ellen was home, if anybody came to visit, they would put Ellen in a closet. Wow. Yeah, that was how she lived, how she grew up. She was the one who, after her stepmother died, to whom she was very devoted, stayed and cared for the father, the stepfather, who was
foster father,
who was very, very sick. And then, once Ellen did that, their daughter told Ellen to get out. And she really pretty much hit the Gloucester streets. And she would sleep where she could sleep. She'd tell stories about ringing the doorbell at St. Anne's and asking Father Sullivan if she could come in and sleep on the couch. And she became quite psychotic, would be the diagnosis. She started to drink terribly. And eventually she would try to get a place wherever she could live. And the final place where she was with a man, and she had her own room. And the thing she had to do for him was to go to the liquor store and get him a bottle once every couple of days. And Thanksgiving Day, he lit the stove or something. By the time And she was back, and she smelled the smoke, and she went and she tried to get him out of the house. She tried to get him through a window.
Yeah. He was a heavy man.
And she could not do that. So the Red Cross put her in a motel. And then they were in touch with us, because by that point we were not. I mean, people knew us, and people knew what we were doing. But so the Red Cross called, and they said, "Is there any chance that you could take this woman?" And we heard the story, and we said, "Yes, we thought we could do that." And so it was December 8th, and Ellen arrived. There's a picture of her somewhere with her coming down the hill. Coming down Essex Avenue with a green bag, with everything she had in it. And she had her Gloucester hat on, and she had three layers of clothes on, just as women do who live on the streets to be safe. And she came in, and from the moment we saw her, we loved her. So she had a birthday right after that, December 15th. Rosemary made her a birthday cake, big chocolate birthday cake, put it down in front of her, and Ellen, the tears. First birthday cake I've had in my whole life. She was in her 30s at that point. And we, of course, being the good caretakers, gave her pajamas for her present, because we never wore pajamas. She always had all her clothes on. And so she did wear her pajamas, but she wore them over her jeans. I can't tell you. I mean, she was just quite something. So this person that Rosemary was telling him about, this man who had a very, very serious alcohol problem, Ellen loaned him some money, right? And so I knew this. And I said to Ellen, really, it's just not going to help Sid for you to be loaning him money. And she looked at me, and she said, "Now, I really respect you, but listen to me." She had her finger like this. And I said, "Okay. Don't you ever tell me whom I can give money to. You don't know anything about our history. You don't know how many times he has given me money. And you're not going to tell me that. And if you do, I'm out of here." Now, you want to know how you break down class and how you know that we're teaching each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what happens. And Ellen just, we had to fight for her. She'd been turned down for Social Security disability 3 times. And Mary Grace was determined that that just absolutely should not happen. She and Mary Jane started working. They got her back for an appeal, and the judge listened to that case and said, "I am so ashamed of the Commonwealth. And I am not only going to approve her for Social Security disability, I am going back, and we are giving her, she's to get a lump sum of all those years that she didn't get it." And what did Ellen do first? She gave a party. She had us all down at Augustine's, and she hosted this party. And here we all were, and she had, it was absolutely lovely. And Ellen loved food. She literally loved food. So she had a spread that. And that's the stuff that happens. So that really begins to break class. And then when Mary Jane was her representative payee, and Ellen, when Mary Jane was diagnosed with macular degeneration, she had to tell Ellen that she couldn't take her every week to the bank, and she couldn't do that anymore. And she said to Ellen, by this time Ellen had a car whom she called, what did she call it?
Mr. Sister.
Mr. Sister. She had this car. She'd gotten her driver's license. She had Mr. Sister. And Mary Jane said, "Do you think you could drive me?" And the story is that Ellen just absolutely, this is what she said. She just put her hand, she said, I don't believe this. I never thought I'd be carting your ass around Gloucester. And she did.
She was special.
And she did. She was unbelievable. You live with people like that. You just do, and respect and love, and you know, and that, and of course the thing was that Ellen, I think just, well, she represented that mutuality. Mm-hmm. It's not easy though, breaking down the, and also the race thing, you know, it's not, but diversity. I mean, we can't just be mutual with people who look like us. We have to be, you know, mutual with everyone. She was just, and then she, you know, when she died, basically she aspirated after some surgery, and she was unconscious at Addison Gilbert, and her mother, her birth mother, was a nurse and recognized something was wrong. And so they flew her into Mass General, and she never gained consciousness. And then it was Rosemary and Mary Jane and I who they called from the hospital and said, we'd like you to come in. And when we came in, her mother and stepfather were there, and they said, you know, she's just, I mean, her lungs are so damaged that she, you know, we can keep her rest, but... And basically said, this is what we would recommend. And her mother could not make that choice. Now, the mother who had not been able to claim her as a child could not make the choice to end, you know, to pull. And she looked to us and she said, what do you think I should do? And we said, one by one, we said, we don't want her to suffer. And so we were with her when they turned off the machines, and again, her mother said, I can't do that. I can't be there. Mm. But then, we also paid. You know, we paid for the funeral, and it's just what you do. It happens. That just happened, and that's what happens. She was just amazing, and she had to be with us every Christmas, every holiday. Ellen was there, and I will say this: Ellen was the reason that we bought Chestnut Street. Because Ellen spent her years after us. In winter, she was on the back shore in one of the hotels. She'd have a room. And in the summer, she had to go to the campground. And she did that back and forth, coming over to us for meals. And somebody said, you know what? She just needs a place. And there was no way she could afford a place. And so this, after we did Washington Street, and then we did Chestnut Street. Was, I mean, every buddy who owned houses in Gloucester was calling us at that point. Once we did Washington, we got the place just for you girls. Yes, just for us girls is right. But anyway, we did Chestnut Street because that meant, and then we had to, because we had imagined it could be for women, but there were men already in there. And so the housing authority said, you can't put the guys out. So we then had five men and five women, and that was all, you know, it was just a minute. And Ellen had a bedroom of her own. And she bought her furniture because of that big, you know, that big windfall she got. You know, she had the most beautiful furniture and a big TV, and she was just amazing. And then she got housing in one of the elderly housing places eventually. But she was just an amazing woman. And she could cut through, I tell you, talk about class, she could cut through it all. She wanted to go to New York, so I took her to New York. Three years, we'd go for a weekend. And Ellen in Tiffany's was something else. I'm telling you, she was absolutely amazing. Showing them the gold watch that she had bought in Gloucester for $400 or some, and they had a gold watch that was $5,000. She'd say to the guy behind the thing, you got to be shitting me. I can't believe this. That's just how she spoke. And it was so real, and she was so beautiful. And yet, what was it that she could recite from heart?
The
No, no, it was
The Raven.
Yeah. She could recite that poem by Edgar Allan Poe. She could do it from the beginning to the end. She just didn't have a chance, you know. Yeah. She went to St. Anne's School. She got grammar school. Evidently, she got put out so many times for playing marbles and never just to play marbles, but to get money from it, you know. Ellen had to survive. Anyway. That may be extreme place, but I think the other thing is that to include people of different classes from us in our discussions, and to know that they have so much to give, and to really, and that we're all, you know, and encourage that. Yeah. But it ain't easy.
So I think probably it's almost time we should wrap up and know that we will have you back in the fall. And anything else that we should say or do?
Don't think. We will. We'll keep working on the book.
Yeah, we're here by the book. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, we didn't spend much time talking about that, which we planned to do.
Tell us a little bit.
Tell us. Yeah.
How far along are we?
Actually on paper, not very far. we've done an introduction and a bit more, but a great deal of talking. We had hoped to do some more on it in the last month since we've been here, but circumstances have not allowed that. But
really, with meeting with the staff and asking staff, what do you think from your experience as Wellspring we need to include in the book? I mean, you've asked questions, but in asking the questions, we'll put down those questions. And we're really looking at symbols, you know, community, place, you know, the house, the garden, food. All those things are going to be things that are going to be in the book, along with, obviously, stories and theory. And that's where we are. So if you have any ideas about what we need to put in the book, for God's sake, will you shoot them to us?
Sure.
Email. nschwoyer@gmail.com.
But thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.